Hey friends, this is Patrick Barney, one of the hosts of the program you're listening to, the Book Spider Podcast, which covers literature, criticism, and on occasion, philosophy related to fiction. With me are, as always, my fellow hosts, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. As usual, we're discussing a novel, Watchers by Dean Koontz, but less as usual, we're also discussing Abduction by Robin Cook. I originally chose Watchers because I wanted to devote an episode to a discussion of less than stellar writing. Typically, we choose highbrow stuff like Shakespeare, Austin, DeLillo, Pynchon, Melville, etc. But I thought it would be fun to think about writing that isn't necessarily up to the standards of authors like these. So I suggested Watchers to Chris and Hans, and then Chris and Hans came back with, well, there's this other book that's really fucking awful called Abduction. So let's read that one too. And that's by Robin Cook, who later on got big writing medical thrillers. So he's a best-selling medical thriller novelist. So since we're really, I don't know how much we're going to talk about plot. Like, this seems to be more of a larger discussion of what bad writing is type of episode. I don't want to spend a long time on summaries, so I'll just say Abduction is about a group of scientists and naval personnel who, in a deep sea submersible, get sucked into some kind of hole in the Earth's crust while there's like some kind of accident going on under the sea. And it turns out they've been sucked into this hole by a race of human beings who live in empty thermal pockets of the Earth's crust. They live in a utopia without want or desire, with infinite lifespans to have sex with one another. They want to remain a secret, so they aren't going to let our cast of characters leave. So, you know, shenanigans ensue because most of our cast of characters does, in fact, want to leave. Though, why you would want to leave a utopia, I'm not quite sure. So that's Abduction. Watchers, the novel by Koontz, teams up Travis Cornell, an elite ex-military officer who is lonely and depressed after the death of everyone he loves, with Einstein, a golden retriever with the intelligence equal to a human being, and Nora Devon, a shut-in who has been so emotionally abused by the aunt who raised her that she doesn't know that she is in fact a hottie. Einstein has been created in a laboratory as part of a military research project, but he escaped because, you know, the scientists mistreated him, poked him with needles and stuff. Another creation of the project, a baboon-like killing machine called the Outsider, has also escaped and is intent on killing Einstein. Other plot lines of the novel include the story of Vincent Nasco, a professional hitman charged with covering up the research project by killing all the doctors involved, and also the story of Lemuel Johnson, the NSA agent who has to keep the project under wraps. It's all pretty bloody and disgusting, except for the overly sentimental sex scenes between Travis and Nora, which are even more disgusting, actually. So those are the basics. Let's chat. The first thing I think I wanted to talk about was some of the rules of good writing that we think both Watchers and Abduction violate. So not necessarily the same rules for each book, but just some basic techniques that any decent writer would employ that these novels do not do very well. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I've got a few. Do you want to start with one book or just sort of bounce between them, or...
Let's just bounce back and forth, I guess, would be my idea.
I only had one for Watchers, because Watchers is, like, I'll just come out and say it, like, about 1,000 times better than Abduction.
It is better than Abduction. I don't think it's great, but I don't think it's better than Abduction.
Yeah, I'm being mean-hearted, mean-spirited about how bad Abduction is when I say that. But I realized as I was reading these that I sort of wrote them like blurbs. So you can imagine this is a blurb on. It's not really a rule, I guess.
That's fine. Breaking. Whatever you came up with is cool.
This is the one that I got for Watchers. Stephen King may be a great writer, but 80% of Stephen King is dog shit. And that's just, I think, a reflection of there's so many beats in this and so many like in Watchers that feel sort of like someone, you know, cut the silhouettes of characters out of, you know, a Stephen King novel. And some of the, like, sort of, even some of the arcs, you know, like, it does sort of feel like a Stephen King thing to have a killer who is, you know, sort of peculiar, vaguely supernatural, can be, in this case, maybe, like, psychological peculiarities and a confrontation, you know, that, you know, you build toward, you know, from these, you know, different viewpoint characters that are like, I don't know. I'm not doing a very good job of summing it up, but it felt like this is a story that Stephen King would tell a lot better. So I guess the rule that Dean Koontz broke is to tell a Stephen King story when really Stephen King should be telling those stories. But that's my first rule.
And Stephen King's not even that great. Like, he's all right. Like, he's okay, but he's not, I wouldn't say he's like great.
Stephen King is mostly like super prolific, and he has because he's written like millions and millions of words, he flirts occasionally with greatness. I'll stand by that. I think that Stephen King occasionally flirts. Does really, really great, like great things. But the ratio is
sure.
is diluted massively by stuff that's not as good, but it's still way better than Watchers.
Yeah, I think Watchers. I don't know if this is like so basic that it's not even, I don't even know if it's a rule precisely, but like, I don't know. Watchers just felt to me like a first draft, essentially. Like at a sentence level, it's just so full of awkwardly chosen words and sentences that don't really have any kind of rhythm or poetry to them. And just the weirdest, like odd things that it seems like any editor would catch or that any writer would catch on like a second or third pass, you know, like just off the top of my head, the very early on, there's a line where Travis is out in the hills and he sees a rattlesnake on a rock 50 feet away. He looks at the rattlesnake, takes one step toward it, and it says, "The rattler began to coil. Soon it would realize that it could not strike at such a distance." So the rattlesnake doesn't know that it can't strike a man 50 feet away?
Yeah.
Like, how stupid is this rattlesnake, you know? Or like, there's another thing that struck me, like when Nora is reflecting on things that her aunt has told her about life, at some point her aunt has like the metaphor of cats and mice, right? Like some people are cats and some people are mice. And the aunt is kind of like explaining the terms of catdom and mousedom. And the aunt says that that if mice are smart, they'll live longer than cats. And it's like, well, that's not true because...
True.
Yeah, like cats live like 10 or 15 years or more.
Or more.
Even like, yeah, and even a very healthy mouse in captivity lives like 2 or 3 years, right? So,
right.
And obviously it's a metaphor, but like, It's
a bad one.
It's just stupid. Well, and beyond the basic badness of the metaphor, it's like you could take out that one sentence and like not have anything in the metaphor seem nearly so off, right? And again, it's I don't know. It just seems like something that a decent editor or reviser would have caught. Or I for the first maybe 30% of the novel, I highlighted a lot of these, right? And there's some that are like more just like just at random here. Looking down that sloped path, he could see only 15 yards before a surprisingly seamless darkness fell across the trail. I don't think I've ever looked at darkness and gone, wait a minute, that darkness doesn't have any seams in it. I'm surprised. It's just like all like that. It just feels, you know, like there's a, I was reading a Neal Stephenson essay about art. And he used the term micro decisions, right? That all art making is like people put too much emphasis on the idea, but all art making is basically a series of like tiny decisions that you make over the course of the creative act. And there are just so many like bad micro decisions in the writing of this, and they fall into a number of different categories.
Yeah, sure.
And then the other thing that like, seems first drafty about it to me is, I don't know if this registered with you guys, but the, you know, he spends the whole novel building up this confrontation between and then it just almost immediately like, oh, Vince Nasco shows up and they shoot him, and the Outsiders shows up and they shoot him, and it's like each of those confrontations is like literally
the whole
novel is like 400 pages of building up to these confrontations with these, and then they just boom, boom.
Well, it's not even just that they're both shot. The outsider thinks or says that it thinks it killed the dog, Einstein, and then just decides to die. So basically, like the whole effort that you know they take to kind of protect Einstein is a failure, and and then Einstein's alive, so it's sort of it's a very strange way to end it.
And
yeah, it's definitely really bad on that level.
Yeah, and that's again, that's something that could be fixed in revision, right? Because like it you trim everything up until then, because it is longer than it needs to be. Like it got to I don't know, like it for a while I was having fun trying to, you know, catch little stuff like the things I was just picking on, but then at some point it just gets tedious because it it's very clear after maybe like the first third of the novel exactly what is happening and will happen.
Right.
And there's not really any suspense, and there's nothing really to be figured out, and it's just like endless plot mechanics that are generally many more words than need to be.
Like how many times does you know Johnson need to show up on the scene of like some animal slaughter? Like how many times do we have to see that, you know? And especially when Johnson doesn't even do anything.
At the end of the novel, he just goes, I'll take your word for it that super smart dog is dead, even though I see that it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Yeah.
Well,
their big plan is he's buried and I don't want you to disturb his resting site.
Yeah, that's Cornell and Nora's plan. Like, oh my god. Oh Jesus. It's too fairy tale.
And this is why, I don't know, like I actually, it's funny because I went into this expecting to have a good time with it, you know? I thought it would be in some sense bad, but I honestly did go into Watchers thinking, okay, like, I don't know, this is like maybe dollar store Michael Crichton, but like, I like Michael Crichton. We've spoken respectfully about other of his works on the podcast. Like, I kind of went in wanting to give it a fair shake to be a fun read or to be like genuinely suspenseful, entertaining, or interesting. And it was it was just so underdone. It was so like half-assed, and that really kind of irked me, honestly. And I think, you know, it's been a long time since It's been a long time since anybody put that much effort into the whole kind of genre versus literary debate, right? And we've all decided that we're done privileging literary fiction over genre fiction. But like, this is why people used to look down on genre fiction, because
sure,
because it's just half-assed, you know. It's not it. Dean Koontz, I guess, may think that he cares about good writing and may believe that he has the same kind of craft and values that a quote-unquote literary author does, but the evidence of the book itself really doesn't seem to suggest that, you know, especially since right. I don't know if you guys had the afterword in your edition, but apparently this is
like, I did.
A beloved yeah. I read the whole thing thinking, well, this is, I mean, he's got a bazillion books, like this might be kind of like a just
no, this is his
masterpiece.
Most favorite one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, this is the one that everybody loves and has had multiple editions, been on the bestseller list many times.
And I thought it was, you know, you guys mentioned Abduction, and I think this is a very interesting pairing in a lot of different ways, actually, right? Partly because, like, Abduction is, I don't know, maybe you guys would disagree, but I think Abduction is actually much more cleanly written at a sentence level. It feels more edited. It feels more polished. It didn't feel like Watchers just kind of felt like it was wasting my time a lot of the time. And I read the last maybe 60% of it, honestly, pretty quickly. I was kind of skimming a lot of the time. Whereas Abduction, like, it feels like, you know, you can't like shove a knife between the bricks, right? Like it's structurally sentence level. It's pretty taut, but the fundamental premise is so breathtakingly stupid, right? So they're different. They're totally different bad books in that regard, where one is arguably a good premise for a, you know, the kind of novel that it is, but very poorly executed. And the other is a pretty competent execution of a dreadful premise. And also, The Watchers, as you mentioned, Patrick, is like the Dean Koontz novel. Right. And Abduction, I don't know. I think it came out in 2000, if I remember right. So I don't think it's like an early
right?
Robin Cook novel. Yeah.
Oh, it's not?
I think it's actually like a mid to late career work, I believe, if I'm understanding the chronology right. But every other Robin Cook, yeah, but every other Robin Cook novel is about like murders in the hospital, you know, and this one, it's just this huge departure from his normal style. It's my Kindle edition was subtitled A Medical Thriller.
Yes.
Which is
mine too.
So hilariously inappropriate, right? But it's like this weird outlier, I think, in what's otherwise maybe not a more distinguished collection, but a totally different body of work.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah. His first book, Year of the Intern, came out in 1972. His most recent is Bellevue this year, and Abduction is 2000. So this is like early latter half of his career.
So yeah, mid-career. And I think it's the only one that's not set in a hospital. So it's a weird departure. I was surprised there wasn't more. I couldn't really find a lot of writing about it or reviews or just any kind of acknowledgement of it, which is kind of odd because it is such a... surely somebody at the time went, what the fuck? But
interestingly, Abduction is not available on Audible, which I find weird since he's a best-selling author and there's a bunch of his stuff available elsewhere. So I ended up getting a Kindle edition and having Alexa read it to me on my phone while I was walking around, delivering mail. But I think that's interesting. Maybe it's like a after the fact, people are like, what the fuck? Like you said, Hans, like they didn't do it beforehand, but now they're like, why did we release this? I'd say I put Watchers, I rank Watchers above Abduction, because at least Watchers has some tension early on. It's long-winded, like, and the climax is like disappointing, since like there's this huge build-up and like Nasco and The Outsider are just dealt with immediately without too much trouble. So there are definitely problems with Watchers, but Abduction, like, I just never had any interest at all from at any point. Like, all the characters are very one-dimensional. The characters in Watchers are one-dimensional too. For Abduction, it felt worse to me for some reason. And the lack of tension, like, I don't know what it is, but Abduction just seems to lack tension at every point to me. Like, there's at no point did I feel any kind of, like, interest in what was going to happen.
Right.
I'll read my other blurb, my blurb for Abduction. It's clear that an underwater welder fucked Robin Cook's wife at some point. Because I think, like, part of what makes, going into this, actually, like, Hans, you were the one who remembered I'd brought up Abduction in the past when Patrick suggested this idea, and I did too. Like, you said, I said this, like, no, it wasn't Dean Koontz, but it was another writer like him. And we sort of touched on this, like, idea of, like, a class of writers, maybe even a generation of writers in the, like, 60s, 70s, 80s, Michael Crichton, you know, I don't know if I'd put Clive, but maybe my hesitation to put, like, Clive Cussler and others in there is that it isn't Tom Clancy, but it feels like that class is actually maybe, like, there are subgroups within that. And Dean Koontz is, I really do. I've read another book by Koontz, only one other one. It was about a boy with eye cancer who could see into a different dimension and transport people into that dimension. No, I'm not fucking with you. A guy, a sociopath who murdered his fiance and is basically, like, covering that up. That even that premise, you know, feels very. Maybe it's not fair to say that Stephen King, like, this is a Stephen King-y premise, but basically, like, you have this sort of supernatural or science technical adjacent capability in, like, a marginalized, you know, figure who is sort of the underdog, and then you have this scary other figure, and they don't even necessarily they're not even necessarily aware of each other. But the story progresses and you follow them and you know that they're going to, like, come into conflict at some point. Maybe it's just actually a generational thing, but that doesn't feel like, you know, that feels like, you know, something that the that the Dean Koontz class of writer does and that the Robin Cook class of writer doesn't. And the Robin Cook kind of techno thriller is sort of necessarily much more svelte. Like, it just is, like, it just does what it, you know, like, it's laying out, it does its sort of techno porn, science porn shit where, like, it's, like, you know, describing, you know, the molecular malleability of these futuristic doors that, you know, open and close without a seam. And it tells a kind of, you know, really stupid story, very competently. And I think that it's maybe a subjective thing. I definitely elevate the Koontz class of writer a little bit above the just straight as an arrow techno thriller. And I think part of it is due to the fact that the welders, the underwater the divers are the two of the worst characters ever written, like, of all time. Like, they're incredibly terrible. And and they serve, they're really like, it's an such a fascinating thing, because like really like they exist to serve like a kind of a plot, you know, role. They're there to be the ultimate wedge that like drives these people out of, you know, this utopian underworld. And we don't have to fucking spend so much goddamn time with them for that to happen. Like they can be hateful pricks, but for some reason, like we have to like and just like the way that they're introduced,
like almost the main characters, really.
It's amazing. Like
we spend more time with them than anyone else.
It's just an incredible. Yeah. It's an incredible decision. I have to pull this up. To spend so much time with these people, and this is like how they're fucking introduced, is like the three had trained together. Hold on, I'll find it. Manliness was a critical virtue for all three men. They were ruthless in punishing anyone they perceived as being less manly than they, who had the nerve to enter a bar in which they were drinking. Their judgment fell heavily on shyster lawyers and fat-assed army personnel. They also condemned anyone they deemed a dork, nerd, or queer. Homosexuality bothered them the most, and as far as they were concerned, the military's don't ask, don't tell policy was ridiculous and a personal affront. And it's like, and that's like, I've just cherry-picked that. There's like lots of that, like just exposition descriptions of like, these people are fucking pieces of shit, and we're going to spend 40% of the novel with them. And it's like, it's incredible.
I'm glad you brought that section up, Chris, because I actually think exposition is something that both of these novels do really, really badly.
Really, yeah, very badly.
Abduction definitely does it badly. And Watchers, there's just so much of like the he reveals so much of the backstory of all the characters in the same way. It's like, it's not as like, you know, in that section you just read, Chris, he's clearly setting these people up to be horrible because they're going to play plot points down the line. But like, you know, Kuntz is just as guilty when he like talks about Cornell's like first wife. You know, 10 months later, she was dead. And then it's like in 200 words or something, we just get all this history. And it's really, really poorly done, I would say. Really poorly done.
I have a question for you, Patrick.
Yes.
And I should note here, for listeners, another way that these books are distinct from each other is that, Patrick, you read Watchers as a teenager and really enjoyed it. And yeah. Chris, you read Abduction as a teenager and thought it sucked. And so you each had, even though like we've identified them both as bad books, like you have had drastically different experiences with, you know, your initial read of them. So, Patrick, I was wondering, you know, every now and again, I've gone back and read something that was significant to me as a teenager or a young adult that is clearly, you know, with the aesthetics of a 40-year-old is not as good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of like a double consciousness effect where you're aware of both kind of the nostalgic, as a reader, you're aware simultaneously of the nostalgic reenactment of your response to something as a young person and your current awareness of the ways in which it fails. And you can almost kind of like those two impulses struggle against each other a little bit sometimes. Did you have that complicated a response to it, or was it just, oh, this sucks?
No, I had that. I had a complicated response. Like, I absolutely like, When I was listening to it again, I recalled like how when I first read it, I was, you know, I don't remember an exact chronology of what happened in my life because this is 25 years ago, but I do remember feeling like at the time I wanted books that interested me right away, and this book interested me right away when I was younger. So I had that complex kind of nostalgic feeling. But then there were also times when, you know, I was just like, I can see why I thought this was fun back then, but it's bad, you know. Like with Vincent Nasco, like I kept thinking about how bad of a character he is. I mean, they're all bad. Like Travis Cornell, and that was something that I think really showed up in Watchers was Mary Sueism, how like everybody is a badass at something. You know, Travis Cornell just happens to be a member of an ex-member of an elite Delta Force, so he can handle the NSA. Oh my God. So I did have that double consciousness that you're talking about, Hans.
Do you think that, like, because I think that if I had read Watchers as, you know, like a 13, 14 year old, I think that that's maybe about when I read Abduction. I would definitely be much more affectionate to Watchers. And I think it is like when you're older, it's super fucking saccharine. It's just like, Jesus Christ, like dogs and humans love each other. God, you know, I love dogs, you know, but I don't, you know, it doesn't have, it's peas and it's carrots and the different things on the plate are never mixed up where like you have like anything like complicated enough in like an interaction or in relationship for it to like really fracture along interesting lines. It's just basically like very, very sweet. And I think I think I would be amenable. I think I would enjoy that book. I think I would look back fondly on that book. And you know, that's just a different thing from like techno thrillers are usually pretty optimistic too, and I don't think Abduction is. It's a super cynical book. So I think that, you know, part of it may be that is just that, like, you know, when you're younger, it's a little bit harder to distinguish the saccharine from the, you know, like the well balanced sweetness of something that's a little more complex.
Right. You know, Watchers is like a rich, heavy dessert that only has one note, you know, to the taste, right? Like there's nothing deeper. And then when you're older, you start to appreciate desserts with like maybe floral notes or nutty notes, you know, you kind of get into something and then you go back to this and you're like, oh damn, this is too much.
I will admit, I guess, thinking about Watchers, the sentimentality of it, right, the extreme sentimentality of it, and the way that the title phrase is eventually revealed to mean, like, people should watch out for each other, right? Like,
right. Which is bad. So bad.
Which is bad.
So but horrible.
It is a little bit... It's like that sentimentality is both like saccharine and overdone and one note and kind of the only sort of redeeming thing about it in a way, like because there's an earnestness, I think, to that sentimentality and a kind of intensity and a purity to it that I can't help but be. I'm not moved by, but I'm fond of it in the way that one is fond of a big, dumb golden retriever, you know.
Sure.
I felt more fond of that aspect of it than I did of, you know, the adventure plot aspect of it or the sentence level writing or, I mean, like almost everything else about it is just kind of is wrong in some basic way. And the sentimentality, at least like it, I don't know, like he has some aspiration to say something meaningful about the human condition, right?
Right.
I guess it's another way that these are completely opposed novels, actually, is that Watchers is ultimately like a very optimistic novel about people connecting and about that being a key part of being human. And Abduction is very, very misanthropic and is just kind of ultimately about all these dumb people, you know, turning down the opportunity for eternal, for heaven, essentially, right?
Right. Except for the, I have totally forgotten every single name in that book. Like, nobody
except
was memorable.
Except for Suzanne. Yeah.
Suzanne. Right.
Suzanne stays.
Well, and there is someone from the surface who, like, who's been down there for decades and then is like, I want to get fucking back. That's
right.
Harvey. And there is like a like it's there's such a because the abduction is so so fatless in its just pursuit of the plot line, like you get these hints at like something more insidious, you know, down, you know, in I don't even remember what the fucking place is called.
Interterra.
Interterra.
Which was a name
that's
I
right.
fucking cracked up on.
Yeah, that's right.
I like legit laughed when they're like, we're from Interterra. I was like,
yeah.
Oh my God, that was stupid. Oh,
yeah,
no.
That is very stupid. But okay, so like there's clone workers. They have like bred like violence out of themselves. They're really like the pleasant sort of like controlling nature of that space really like seems like interesting fertile ground for some kind of, you know, child in the basement of Omelas, right? And it just doesn't fucking happen. Like it's like it is somehow still a story about like us stupid barbaric surface people rejecting this perfect place, but like, you know, the perfect place, there's definitely something odd about it. And it's, you know, like, I don't know that I would be comfortable fucking staying there, you know? And, you know, it's just, it's irritating to me that the book is somehow, like, taking the not scenic, it's like there's several routes to get to the ending, and it takes the worst one. Like, it goes down the worst path every single time. But anyway.
Was anybody else pissed when they got to the end of Abduction and there was a fucking glossary?
I didn't even look at it. I saw your question, but...
Well, the book just kind of kept reading on, like it went to the end and I thought it was over, and then I hadn't had a chance to press pause on my phone, and so the glossary...
Really short glossary.
Right, but like it feels the need to define, for example, Richter scale.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, I was like, you gotta be... Like, I was pissed because, like... So in my mind, I was comparing it to a novel like His Master's Voice, which is definitely heavy on the technicalities, but is way better. It's more ambiguous and, you know, it's just a better novel, I think. I hope we all agree on that.
Oh, that's
for sure.
Obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like there's heavy technicalities. A lot of the terms in His Master's Voice are not like not something that you just understand right off the bat. And yet it does not include a glossary. And I mean, I'm not saying I understood every term that Cook uses in Abduction right away. But I certainly was not like, oh my God, this science is blowing my fucking mind. You know, I wasn't like, holy shit, this is like the idea of like some kind of inter-pocket livable zone with, you know, like it felt strange to me because like I come to the end and I'm thinking, If he had been ironic about this, this would have been funny and good. But oh no, he's taking himself very seriously here with all this techno babble. Like, this is like the coolest part of the novel, and it's not cool at all. I don't know.
It needs a Mystery Science Theater 3000 like footnote vibe, like,
yeah,
vibe, rather than a glossary.
I suppose the glossary is probably, it suggests the priorities of the audience to the extent that, like, I might be stereotyping here to some extent, but I get, you know, like, if you talk to people who mainly read literary or mainly read genre fiction, a lot of them kind of, like, I knew people, I had students when I was teaching in Alaska who would say, like, oh, I like reading novels because actually you still learn things from them, right? Like, they think of a novel as, like, they would think of a novel like this as partly being, to the extent that reading a novel is kind of a frivolous practice, like, it's redeemable as a way of learning some science while you're at it, right? Like, and I think that the glossary probably suggests an audience that, like, wants to, you know, like, an audience of people who want to come out with some scientific knowledge because they don't think of reading fiction as being kind of an aesthetic end unto itself.
Is that a different audience than Watchers? Are these, like, different? Is it, you know, like you mentioned, genre fiction, people who are reading just genre fiction, but within that, like, pool, are there, like, different markets that these two writers are sort of, like, writing to? Because, like, you know, as much as we're talking about how bad these novels are, they're more successful than most of the novels we've actually talked about on this podcast.
Maybe so more there's than something, any novel we've talked about.
Maybe. So what is there something, you know, in spite of or like related to their badness in, you know, that says anything about their audiences? And you already kind of talked about Abduction, but I was curious if you thought that Kuntz is maybe a little bit different.
Well, in the AI discussion, there was that one of, I forget his name, but he said people like kitsch, people like bad writing. You know, they like bad art and bad writing because it's easy. And you know, I definitely think that works for Watchers. You know, it's not good, but it's like, you know, it's got kind of an action storyline, a romance storyline. It's got a bunch of different kind of genre-esque plot lines in it. And it's all very sentimental, so it doesn't make you feel bad. I mean, even though, like, there's a bunch of disgusting things in there, it makes you feel like the good guys win in the end. You know, the couple gets to live happily ever after and all this stuff. So I think that's a reasonable explanation of, like, if anything's going to be commercially successful, it's going to be something like that, right? Like, to the extent that Watchers is commercially successful.
Yeah, I guess if you take that, well, I don't know, maybe it doesn't matter that it's so bad at a sentence level, right? I was going to say, like, if you take that and then add better editing, tighter writing, no references to a ceiling as looking like a tiger of infinite length jumping forever, then maybe, like, you don't even need to tighten those things up to make it any more commercial, right? I mean,
right.
I guess you can't really be more commercially successful than Dean Koontz. Like, that's
right.
Unless you're Stephen King, who, you know, right, is at least a much better writer with a much better sense of the craft of writing. And, I mean, a kind of just a more, you know, like, King's not great, but I think there's a reason that, like King more than anyone else has probably managed to align a very strong instinctive sense of what people will find entertaining with enough legitimate authorial chops to not be the focus of podcasts like this, right? I was reading, this is just an aside, but I think it gives you a sense, I think, of like how much of a fucking hack Dean Koontz is. I was reading his Wikipedia, and not even reading it in that much detail, right? I was just kind of scanning it, and there's a reference to his November 2007 book, The Darkest Evening of the Year, about a woman who rescues a special dog named Nikki, which eventually saves her life. And it's like, oh, wait, a book about a person who rescues a special dog that saves their life? Like, that's super original. Like, that's the fucking plot of The Watchers, right? Like,
right.
And I needed to only read one of his books and skim his Wikipedia article to discover, like, self-plagiarism.
Yeah, yeah.
And I understand on some level those might be different books, but also he just... I don't know. Like, he's just...
I mean, it's the same idea.
Yeah, if one defines a hack as being a commercially successful author who churns out a huge amount of work with little evident regard for quality, regardless of what he might say or might even think, like, I can't think of a more classic hack than Koontz.
The only other one I can think of is Slavoj Žižek. And I'm serious about that. He does the exact same thing. He churns out a bunch of garbage through self-plagiarism and doesn't give a shit about, you know, like, he really doesn't. He just tried to get that fucking cash.
So I want to basically, like, go back to the where the title appears in the in Watchers, because, like, I have this feeling that, like, you know, we all dumped on it, like, this I can't remember what it's called. There's a term for this when the title appears in a story, but the dog has been sick and they're not sure if he's going to be okay. Is it Nora? She's talking to him. We have a responsibility to stand over one another. We are watchers, all of us watchers, guarding against the darkness. And we dumped on it, but I kind of feel like, so I mentioned the techno porn bits of Abduction, and I think that, like, really, like, that's like, I think that, you know, a lot of those books are kind of the same, or, you know, in just different trappings, but the same ideas, same stories. That's why Clive Cussler and Tom Clancy and a lot of them, Ludlum, Cook, you know, Crichton maybe is kind of a standout, you know, in that arena, as like someone who sort of sometimes rose above the lot of them. But the I think that, like, a lot of those different ideas and stories are really just like carriers for techno porn moments. Like, it's really like about, like, those, you know, the person who's reading them being introduced to, like, the exact way in which a, you know, PK-17, you know, pistol, like, you know, reloads a new bullet after, you know, the previous round has been, you know, fired, or, you know, those are really, like, the, I think, kind of what those books are carrying. You know, there's a plot that sort of, like, has forward propulsion, and then those are, like, the calories. Those are, like, the things that, like, you know, like, people sort of return to be filled up on. And I have a feeling that Watchers is about those sort of profundities, like the moments that, like, the, you know, the characters have by themselves or with each other when they're saying really, to us, vapid, empty, sentimental bullshit, you know, like, that's like the Watcher's line, you know, or the agent, you know, wondering if he's loyal to anyone, you know, like, basically, like, these are very simple, like, things, but I think that that's what this type of bad book is really carrying. Like, the ideas can all be the same, like, or the story can recycle a bunch of shit, and even recycle those moments, so long as those moments feel like they're halfway earned. That's what people really, you know, come back for.
And I guess to be a little bit kind to Watchers, the sequence that that follows is the long sequence where Einstein has, I think it's distemper and struggles with an illness, which oddly enough is like five times longer than the sequences where the two long-awaited adversaries show up.
Right.
It's true. Right.
They do. He spends a ton of time on the distemper part, yeah.
But I actually felt like the distemper part was one of the better parts of the book. Like, it felt better paced than a lot of rest of the book.
Yeah.
It had a real kind of pathos to it. Maybe because, I don't know, like, everything else is so exaggerated and so absurd and so, oh, every person he's ever loved died in front of him, or, you know, her aunt told her she was ugly and never let her leave the house, right? Or like, this is a psychopathic hitman who's incredibly powerful but also maybe psychically absorbs the souls of the dead. And then you just have like in the middle of that, you know, you have like people caring for a sick dog that they love. And it felt, it had, I don't know, like it was just, it was good. It was a good sequence. It earned that sentimentality. It earned that sentimentality in a way that almost nothing else in the novel did, actually.
Right. Oh, man. That's hilarious. So, I do want to ask one more question. Well, two more questions. One is easy. So, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do we rate these two books? What is Abduction and what is Watchers? Being the worst trash ever and 10 being your favorite, you know, DeLillo novel or whatever.
We should I think, not to complicate it, but we should give like some tiers. Like 1 to 3 is like absolute garbage. 4 to 6 is like, you know, enjoyable but empty calories. 7 to 10 is, you know, like, I don't know, something like that. Or
yeah, that's good. 1 to 3 is absolute trash. 4 to 6 is enjoyable, but ultimately stupid. And 7 to 10 is fucking
getting,
you know,
up there.
Yeah, getting up there, like the Sotweed factor or something. or
Lookout cartridge.
Or almost
no. Lookout cartridge is not good. Seriously, the Sotweed factor is like a 9.
Sotweed factor is great. Yeah, Sotweed factor is amazing. I'm joking.
All right. I was like, what's your problem with Sotweed factor?
I think some of the more complicated books would make it really hard to put them on a scale like this. I don't know what I would give Lookout Cartridge. I know I didn't enjoy
I didn't enjoy it, but it has to be a 7 at least, right? Like, it's, you know, if,
do you get points for trying to do something and then like failing so fucking spectacularly that like that and being so confusing that like entire like for decades you're perceived as I don't know, like,
yeah, I don't know, maybe if like I wonder if maybe we're making a mistake here in trying to calibrate a scale between books with different objectives, right? I mean, maybe we should be thinking about a 1 to 10 where like 10 is, I don't know, Jurassic Park, right? One is like a self-published romance novel on Kindle full of typos and you know, like,
all right, so
characters' names change halfway through, right? Like,
so maybe like a scale of 1 to 10, but for books that we would probably call low to middle brow
genre fiction.
And
there's just a whole different set of aesthetic priorities between this and, you know, Omen Setter's Luck, right? Like
All right. So on the scale you just talked about, Hans, with 10 being Jurassic Park, which I have read and did enjoy, and 1 being an awful fucking Kindle, self-published Kindle novel with a bunch of typos and changing character names. I give Abduction a 3 because I hated it and thought it sucked, but it's not nearly as bad as that. Like, it's not as bad as that. And I give Watchers like a 5.
Yeah.
On that scale, maybe?
Yeah, same. Yeah. Same.
I probably agree about, I'd give Watchers like a 4.7.
Mm, sure.
I just felt like Watchers was wasting my time. I got mad at Watchers for wasting my time. It's just so flabby, you know?
Yeah, it is flabby. I got mad at Abduction for thinking that I don't know what a fucking Richter scale is. Jesus.
If we're just talking about things that one reads for surface amusement to pass the time, and if it really is like just a genre fiction middle brow scale, I might give Abduction maybe like a 7.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
I thought it was like, I mean, it's very, very stupid. But it's, I don't know. I wasn't bored by it. I found it consistently funny. I mean, it was stupid and abrasive in places, and
yeah, but did you find
it has many flaws, but I if we're judging it against Jurassic Park rather than Omen Setter's Luck, yeah, I'd give it like a, I don't know, 6.5 to 7.
That's interesting to me. Was it, but when you say it was funny, is it like actually funny, or is it, you know, Mystery Science Theater funny?
Oh, it's Mystery Science Theater funny. Yeah. But
that doesn't count in favor of the book, though. That's just your position to it.
Yeah, I liked reading it. I didn't ever think like, fuck, when is this bullshit gonna be over? You know?
No, I definitely did. It was fun to read. I was like, oh man, this is so horrible. I want this to be over.
I think part of that might be, I could be, I'm just guessing here, but like, you listened to Abduction, right? You had Alexa read it to you from a PDF or whatever. I do think with this kind of book,
the Kindle.
Yeah. With this kind of book, I think it is, it's very helpful to be reading it rather than listening to it, because you can rush, you know?
Yeah, you can breeze through it. It takes, like, this is like an 2-hour book, really. Like, if you just allow yourself to cook through it.
I put Alexa on double speed, and I still think it took me like 6 hours, like 3 hours of 2 different shifts.
Yeah,
to finish it. So yeah,
man, Watchers. Like, if I had to listen to Watchers read at normal speed, I would have given it a 1, because it's just so flabby.
No, I always listen at double speed unless like the narrator has an accent that I need to slow down, which every now and then happens. But yeah, double speed is the way to go. Like, the first time I did it, I was like, what? I feel like my life is on fast forward, but then I got used to it. Okay. So the last question, and I wanted to bring this up, I think I already know the answer. Like, we've already kind of gone into it, but I do still want to bring this up. Like, I came back to Watchers after 25 years, and I just had no memory at all of its, like, casual homophobia and its Christian right values and all that jazz. I like it when novels have some kind of worldview or something that they're trying to say. I do like that. And I don't automatically think a novel is bad because it has views that I disagree with. For example, The Garden of Seven Twilights is probably based on like some weird postmodern ideas about truth that I disagree with. But ultimately, I think The Garden of Seven Twilights is a fantastic novel. However, Watchers, I feel like this all these like Christian right values and discussion of God, like that's garbage, right? Like, that makes it a worse novel, right? Or am I wrong?
It made it It was, I don't know, it was just one more dumb thing to slow it down, basically, you know? It was one more thing that would have been cut out of a speedier version of it. I mean, I do think that it, you know, it's funny because we, I don't know about we, but like people that I read, cultural critics I read, are always accusing young people of like not liking subtlety in art and just wanting all the characters to directly mouthpiece the values that, you know, mm-hmm. are the, like the correct ones. And I guess you could accuse us of not, I don't know, like, I mean, it's the characters saying that, not Dean Koontz, right? But it does seem right. to be very clearly an articulate, like there's Koontz. No yeah. irony there. There is one thing I thought was interesting. I mean, it didn't bother me, I think, as much as you, but it also, I mean, I was already kind of just annoyed at a sentence by sentence right. level with the novel. I wouldn't say that it bothered me more than the clumsy writing or the terrible pacing.
Sure.
I did have one thing that I thought about with that, though, and it was that, you know, there's a scene where Travis and Nora go into strip clubs to try to find somebody to make them fake papers, right?
Right.
And then Vince Nasco goes into the same strip clubs to try to, like, track them down afterward. And Nora and Vince Nasco have exactly the same response to the strip club. Like, they both go, yeah. This is disgusting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought it was fascinating that these two characters who are, like, the moral inverses of each other and who are in every way just completely different have this precise response to precisely identical response to the same thing. That's actually a really interesting thing, except that, you know, it's something that I think Koontz does without thinking about the oddity of it, without thinking about
right.
how it suggests, like, it's this weird moment where, like, Nora and Vince end up on the same, they end up in the same place, looking in the same direction, making the same judgment. And the right. fact that these two completely different characters have been made to do this is a really intriguing thing that, goes nowhere because it's just, you know, an accident. But I was interested in that and didn't expect anything to come from it. But an entirely different novel written by an entirely different person could do something really intriguing with that, right. you know?
But as it is, it's the way that this novel incorporates ideas about small government or whatever, whether or not you like small government, is heavy-handed and not great, right?
Right, right. There's also an interesting moment just in terms of, like, thinking about this with the eyes of the future, right? Like, there's a moment where Travis says that the advancement of, he says something like that, the advancement of digital technology and computers will inevitably make the government less powerful and get it right. out of everybody's business, which is
the exact opposite of what happened.
The exact opposite of what happened, right? It's, yeah. which, you know, no points there for prognostication.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so it should be Chris's turn to pick, correct?
Can I yes. actually ask another question before we go?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah, I just was, I'm interested in your answers, and this doesn't, this, I suppose, like, bears somewhat on your experience, Patrick, with Watchers. I'm just curious what you guys will say. Maybe you could almost get maybe a whole podcast out of this, actually. Maybe I should do another episode where it's just this. But my question is, what single novel have you experienced the greatest drop-off in quality between two times that you read it? Meaning, like, you read it one time and you really liked it, you read it another time, you thought it was dreadful. What novel did you have that perception of?
I know exactly which one. Waterland.
Waterland?
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a pretty good answer.
I'm not sure which one, but one of Terry Goodkind's novels.
Well, yeah.
I'm not sure which one, but, like, I'm sure if I went back and I have gone back and read them. I've read a lot of the books a number of times, but never far enough apart where, like, I was out of like the Terry Goodkind space. So like if I reread a Terry Goodkind novel now, I'm something that I loved when I was 17, I would be like, oh my god, you were a fucking moron. I'm sure that would happen. Yes.
Probably for me, I mean, there are two things that come to mind, which I guess is not what I asked, but within the literary space, probably 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And just generally, like, Murakami, you know, like, there was a period in my life where Murakami was one of my favorite authors, and it wasn't that long ago, really. It was, like, after I developed the kind of aesthetic and consciousness that I think of myself as having now.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there was a period where Murakami was one of my favorite authors, and I think now that he has maybe, like, 1.6 good books and an enormous amount of just complete bullshit.
Yeah,
like, and is actually maybe like the single most overrated, if one considers him a literary author, like maybe the most overrated literary author.
Mm.
With if there's any room there for wiggling, really just coming from maybe like maybe translation is affecting something, but like, man, Murakami fucking sucks. Mostly, he has the occasional moment, but like, yeah. And I had such a profound experience reading Wind Up Bird Chronicle. And there are bits of Elephant Vanishes that I've gone back and enjoyed on a reread, but like everything else of his that I've reapproached has just been just
garbage,
dreadful. And the more of it that you read, the more you understand how he just, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this, but how much he really does write the same book over and over and over and over again, you know? And it's not even a very good book for the most part. But probably, like, actually, I was thinking about this in relationship to your question about values, Patrick, right? Which was, you know, when I was 22, I read Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson, who I mentioned earlier in the podcast, and adored it, right? It was one of the best reading experiences I can remember having before grad school, because it is, like, a great adventure novel, and it has a certain sense of romance to it, and it has, you know, the mathematical and technical detail presented in an appealing way that doesn't feel shoehorned in, and a lot of sentence, like genuine sentence level wit and real craft, and is as kind of like a big techno thriller adventure novel, like probably is about as well done as that genre can possibly be done, and right. You know, has some real brains to it. And I read it. It took a pretty long time. Like, I was in it for a long time, and it was that feeling of just being able to live in a world for a you know, great deal of time and miss it so terribly when it was gone. And, yeah, so that was when I was 22. And I reread it right after grad school, so I probably would have been, I don't know, not more than 27. So not a huge amount of time had passed. And,
and you're 40 now, right?
I have not read. I'm 40 now. Yeah, yeah. And I have not reread Cryptonomicon since the reread when I was 27. But it, on a reread, it was, I was so taken aback by how, I mean, it's actually like a very, very culturally conservative novel, right? Like it's very committed to like traditional gender roles and these kinds of very antiquated ideas about relationships and the idea that like the kind of only real valuable way to exist is having either like technical expertise or the ability to fight. And that pretty explicitly kind of goes out of its way to portray people who work in the humanities as, you know, buffoons and charlatans and parasites.
Oh, and that's interesting.
Yeah. And I do think that like, if I were to read it a third time, I might see a lot of subtleties there that I didn't, because I was kind of like in a, you know, like I had a lot of my own issues with my life and how it had turned out in ways that kind of made me very vulnerable to taking that kind of thing personally, you know. And now, like, I probably am maybe even a little bit more generous to the idea that the humanities in academia are kind of full of buffoons and charlatans, but like at the time, I just found it profoundly disturbing and upsetting, and like a particular kind of betrayal that like something I had loved so deeply was telling me that everything I valued was worthless. And it also basically is, you know, reading it with hindsight, it's essentially about, the whole thing is basically about how the invention of Bitcoin is the only thing that will prevent another Holocaust, right? So like it feels like a, like the whole value set that underlies it is basically the combination of religious conservatism plus techno-libertarianism, which is, of course, the thing that is currently running the country. And to be, I do think that, like, I'm probably oversimplifying and misunderstanding it now, right? Like, that was a, that was probably not an adequately, I think that there are a lot of issues with that reading if you were to go back to it, right? But at the time, you know, like, I read it preparing for a flight and just, like, tossed it in the airport garbage when I was done. And obviously, like, I don't think that, you know, Neal Stephenson, he's not out there cheerleading for J.D. Vance, right? Like, he's, he is a much more complicated figure than that. But that individual work, I found, you know, at the time, ideologically loathsome in a way that felt deeply upsetting.
You know, that, that's funny to me because I've actually had that a similar experience with several novels. Specifically coming back to them years later and realizing, oh, the author is a weird conservative that espouses things I dislike. So, like, Watchers does it, Terry Goodkind did it, like, and also Dan Simmons in his sci-fi epic series, The Hyperion Cantos. I remember reading all of these when I was a teenager, really enjoying them, and then I come back and read them later, I'm like, oh, this is weird. Why are these people like this? Why is this, and why is that the case? Right. It's weird.
I wonder what it is about, I was thinking about this, like, we watched Die Hard a few days ago, and Die Hard, the film, like, is completely rooted in, I have no idea, like, what the personal politics of the creators of Die Hard are, but, like, the ideas that underlie the film are completely repulsive, right? Like, I mean, the climactic emotional the climactic emotional moment of the movie is a cop, like, discovering that he can still shoot people, and that's, like,
right.
presented right. as a moment of moving, deeply moving triumph, like, oh, I can still shoot people. I've rediscovered my long-lost ability to shoot people.
I accidentally killed a kid a while ago, and now I can kill an adult. Yeah.
Now I can still shoot people. That's I've overcome my personal trauma to shoot people. And but it didn't bother me, right? Like, I it's a very enjoyable movie. And, you know, like,
it's just good empty calories.
Yeah, it's good. I can take it as good empty calories, even though I also understand that you could write a novel-length work about how it's fascist propaganda. And I don't know why it is that film, I can do that with film in a way that I can't with a book. You know?
Like, it bothers me more with a book, too, than a film. I don't know. Maybe because authors should be better thinkers than that. Like, come on, you know?
Or maybe, yeah, maybe it's because I assume that, like, the politics of a book are an earnest expression of a writer's politics, whereas, like, the fascism of 80s action, in some cases, I think, reflected the real values of the people, but to some extent was also just a set of genre conventions that had no more, in many cases, no more relationship to people's actual feelings than all the death metal songs about rape and murder, right? Like, it's just genre convention.
Right. And, you know, a genre convention that maybe doesn't represent specific actors or writers or directors, but is more representative of, like, 80s Hollywood action as a whole.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway,
sorry, Chris.
Interesting digression. What's your pick, Chris?
So I recently read Young versus Borg, which is a kind of philosophical exploration of how Jungian theory can and, as the author argues, should be applied to prepare us for the cybernetic future to gird us for it, I guess. And I brought that up to you guys as a possibility. It is long, and I would be picking out pieces of it. I don't agree with a lot of what he lays out, but I actually think that that could make the discussion more interesting if we
sure.
do that. This is not fiction. It's like I said, it's a more of a philosophical book. But
it's nonfiction.
It's nonfiction, but I have that as an option, and I have not read her before, I don't believe, but I have been reading about or hearing about Creation Lake by Rachel Kushner, and it is also on my list of books to read. So would you like me to curate some sections of Jung versus Borg? What is this called? Finding the Deeply Human in a Post-Human Age, or would you like to read Rachel Kushner's new book?
I'm fine with either one, but I guess I'll vote for option one, Jung.
Yeah, I'd probably go with that too, actually. I like Rachel Kushner well enough, but I would be... For the purposes of discussion on a podcast, this seems like a pretty interesting route.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, I think that there'll be a lot to dig into. So I'm going to send you guys, because I actually have a copy of it. I'm going to try and make copies of the sections for you. It should be about 100 or so pages. Maybe as much as 200, but it's 500 pages long, which is the other reason why... I was balking initially, but I think I can cut what we can talk about out of that and have it not even be half that length. So I'll send it to you guys.
Sounds interesting. Okay, listeners, thank you for tuning in. If you came in because you clicked on our episode because you like Watchers, then I'm sure you're already gone. But I will apologize to you nonetheless for trashing on something you love. As for the people who like Abduction, screw you. I don't care.
Do those people exist?
I don't know. Peace out, everyone. Have a good day.